Hello, friends, and welcome to program two, actually, in our beginning of the book, Telepathy and the Etheric Vehicle. It seems almost inevitable that when I start one of these books, I have a mishap. And I had a mishap yesterday, which basically made it possible for me to deliver to you the only 40 minutes and 49 seconds of program one, because I simply failed to touch the right button. And I was happily talking along, and nothing was recording. Well, that was interesting. Let's see. So, I have to do that again. And I'm doing it right now before our Science of Triangles meditation. And see, this is what I had, and I'll show you. I had the seven planes of our solar system, and I went into that in considerable detail. And then further than that, let's see if I can find something here that allows me to go down here a bit. No, it doesn't. So, let's see. Yeah, maybe this one. And, further, I had the second of these, and maybe you can see it. Whoa. I'll try to get this up here for you. This would be the evolution of the solar logos, and that we went through. And I used the substitute charts, or the elaborated charts, which Keith Bailey and Tuya have created with the different colors and different indications, which are more revelatory, I think, than this simple chart. But now, what we have to do is something different. Let's see if I can find that. I'm having a little trouble wandering around here. So let's see. Okay, but now we will come to the place where my button pushing did not work so well. And I'll repeat, probably in a brief program, what it is I was talking about. So this is the field of telepathic interplay, and we're beginning on page one of this, page one here. One of the characteristics, says the Tibetan, I'll always try to distinguish with what he is saying and my commentary on it. One of the characteristics distinguishing the group of world servers and knowers is that the outer organization, which holds them integrated is practically non-existent. And may I say, that is something unusual when we think about how organizations on the outer plane are held together. This is quite different, and it has a subjective basis. The workers here in the new group of world servers and knowers, about them the Tibetan says the following. They are held together by the inner structure of thought and by a telepathic medium of interrelation. Now ponder on that just a little bit. They, may I say, they do adhere to some similarity of thought, which gives for them, despite all of their differences, a common goal, a goal held in common. And because they can reach each other telepathically without working without being on the outer plane, basically a telepathic medium of interrelation. And the farther we go, may I say, I use that may I say when I'm making my own comments, okay, the farther we climb on the ladder of hierarchy, the more this telepathic medium of interrelation is effective. The DK goes on. The great ones whom we all seek to serve, and may I say that that means that the Tibetan too has those for him are the great ones, greater than he, and he is known by reputation for his selfless service. So just note that. People like you, and I, we serve those who are our superiors and know more about the divine plan than we can possibly know. And the Tibetan does likewise. So coming back to what he says, the great ones whom we all seek to serve, and I'm going to emphasize that. Again, the great ones whom we all seek to serve are thus linked and can, at the slightest need and with the least expenditure of force, get en rapport with each other. Now, may I say that's something that we are trying to cultivate. We cannot probably knowingly, with very little expenditure of force, get in touch with each other. But increasingly, it will be the case for the new group of world servers. And right now, it is the case for those who are within the ashram, not just standing on the periphery of the ashram, as was the case for some 50 students in DK's group, to whom he was giving special training, but actually within the ashram, those on the periphery were trying to learn this type of rapport. But let me say that the Tibetan says, we are all naturally telepathic, and somehow we get in our own way through glamour and delusion and fail to exercise our natural telepathic abilities. So, least expenditure of force. That's what he says. And that reminds me of the state number four, stage number four, of little chelaship. That was a mistake. I mean, chela on the thread. Little chelaship is stage number one, but, you know, in a way, when we think about chela on the thread, it's like the beginning of really entering the ashram. So the Tibetan says that the truly selfless student, and for no personal purposes, can draw upon the Tibetan's energy with a very slight expenditure of force from him towards that individual who, for the right reasons, reasons having to do with the work, calls for that expenditure of force. It is the stage immediately before stage five in which you are actually within the ashram. It's called chela in the aura, stage five, and little chela on the thread, stage four. Anyway, with the least expenditure of force, the great ones can get en rapport with each other. So that's something that we are learning. And will it be accomplished in this life, in this incarnation? Well, at least we're on our way. They are, the Tibetan says, they are all tuned to a particular vibration. Now that vibration is distinctive or characteristic of a particular ashram. And as I said, no matter what the divergences, and there are so many, the vibration is similar, and there is attunement to a vibration which is characteristic of that ashram. Okay. Now, you know, I have no idea whether what I'm saying right now was exactly the same as when I discovered my mistake. I always hope that you can see what I'm doing, you know. Okay. I'm just going to always, yeah, looks like we're pretty good. All right. In the new groups are collected together people who are very diverse in their nature. Now, may I say that word people can mean a personality. But I once did find a reference regarding those people whose monads were on the fifth ray. And so it depends on how exacting he is in the use of such a term. Anyway, he has been saying, in the new groups are collected together people who are very diverse in their nature. And this is, may I say, the new groups, even the new groups. They are certainly not carbon copies of each other, and he's going to explain why. So he goes on to say, people who are found upon differing rays, who are of different nationalities, and may I say, that can make quite a difference, and who are each of them the product of widely varying environments and heredity. Now, the different rays, well, maybe in one sense we're looking at the groups as a whole, and of course the ray equipment of economists and scientists naturally has to be somewhat different than the ray equipment of those who are involved in, let's say, education or healing work or work with the new world religion. You see, I'm talking about the seed groups, but even even within the same seed group, there can be those gathered on different rays, though sometimes a particular ray tends to stand out as necessary. For instance, in the case of the sixth ray being quite an unavoidable necessity in those who are doing work as trained observers. We sometimes call it the glamour group, you know. Trained observers, group number two, they have to have that. But still, other rays can be very different. And as far as the national conditioning and their own particular environment, oftentimes very different from that of each other, and even their heredity and what their physical family of origin stamps upon them can be very different. But at least they have this thing called attunement to a particular vibration. Okay. Now, you know, I've just got to keep checking to see that I've done it right. I don't want to have to repeat my repeat. Okay, DK goes on. Besides these obvious factors, which immediately attract attention, may I say, because they are, in a way, outer factors. You can see that. You can see the different nationalities, the different locations. You can see even the heredity. You can see certain of the outer personal rays. So those would be the obvious factors. Okay, but he goes on to say, besides these obvious factors, which immediately attract attention and may I say that's often all we see of another, namely a kind of a superficial appraisal based upon quite visible factors. So he says, besides these obvious factors which immediately attract attention, there is also to be found an equal diversity in the life experience of the souls concerned. And may I say, where have we been as souls? We may be working together now, but where has our soul experience carried us over many, many lives? And what has been the harvest of those many lives? I mean, you can be a twin brother, a twin sister to someone, and obviously you look different to the soul. Though you look identical, more or less, to the from the perspective of the personality. So, an equal diversity in the life experience of the souls concerned. Diversity, may I say, externally, and diversity internally. And may I say that DK is of such psychological acumen that he can, to a very large extent, realize these differences. He can see them. And he knows us well. Of the Christ, it has been said, he knew what was in man. We have that story of him coming to the well where was found the woman of Samaria, was it, drawing water, and Christ simply knew her history, because there was no barrier between himself and her. And then he gave her the appropriate advice. So the complexity of this problem is also tremendously increased, this is the Tibetan saying this, when one remembers the long road which each has traveled, and the many factors emerging out of a dim and distant past. And may I say, I think the Tibetan can see at least some of that. A dim and distant past, and he goes on, which have contributed to making each person what he now is. Now, may I say, what a reading of the record that would require, but maybe not the entire record. Maybe it's not necessary, as some lives have been very uneventful. Maybe it's not necessary, you know, to look up hundreds and hundreds of lives. There are certain outstanding moments in the history of our soul, and maybe those are what count now. So, why are we as we are, I may ask? Due to these many factors on the long road which this soul has trodden. Not exactly the personality. The personality continues to be reconstituted based on more superficial factors. And wouldn't, and may I say, wouldn't it be interesting? And maybe the day comes when we can read the record regarding our own development over the past as an incarnating soul. I think there would be such complexity involved, we'd really have to know what we are doing in order to understand how that in the distant past led to the configuration that we now see and the structure that is now ours. So the Tibetan goes on and says, when therefore one dwells on the barriers and difficulties supervening upon such diverse conditions, barriers as well as difficulties. He goes on to say, the question arises at once, what provides the common meeting ground and what makes it possible to have an interplay between the minds involved? Now, may I say, I'm sure we have not appreciated the implications of that question the way the Tibetan has, because he's seen at first hand the complexity of it all, and we have merely been told that it exists. So if we go, you know, further, I just want to somehow emphasize this statement. Despite everything in these groups, the members, i.e. they are all tuned to a particular vibration, or will be, just or are learning to be, just the way the masters and high initiates already are. So we're at that point, the Tibetan is asking, and you know, I check in every once in a while just to make sure that I'm literally, that we are on the same page. It's always such a crushing moment when you realize you've been thinking, talking, explaining, pointing out, and it's all for naught, you know. But then it's a challenge, and you just redo as you must. Okay. So the Tibetan's question, what provides the common meeting ground amidst such diversity, and what makes it possible to, and may I add, unsuspected diversity in our case, okay? But he simply calls it, diversity. What provides the common meeting ground, he questions, and what makes it possible to have an interplay between the minds involved? And I just want to say that surface things, superficialities, are exactly that. They are evident, but they count for less in the long run than the adherence to a similar goal and the attunement to a similar ashramic vibration. And he goes on to say, the answer to this question is of paramount importance, okay, and necessitates a clear understanding. And may I say, do we sense the careful manner in which the Tibetan is teaching us? It's as if no stone of importance is left unturned. So we cannot ever complain about insufficiency of instruction. We have what we need if we will simply follow that instruction. Okay. Now, he says, when the biblical words are used, in him we live and move and have our being, and may I say, we probably mean both the planetary logos and the solar logos, and ultimately something much higher. But locally, we mean the planetary logos as a great a scheme entity who is part of the solar logos. When the biblical words are used, says DK, in him, capital H, we live and move and have our being, we have the statement of a fundamental law in nature, and the enunciated basis of the fact, which we cover by the rather meaningless word omnipresence. Well, may I say, I've always considered omnipresence a pretty good word. It means something to me, but the Tibetan knows better. And I sometimes substitute the word ubiquity, which means being everywhere, and even a coined word, everywhereness. These words are associated with the third aspect of divinity, and it's maybe one of the first things realized before we can really gain understanding of omniscience, which seems to me not only of the second ray, but a kind of combination of the second and third, and of course, maybe an easier to understand word, which we call omnipotence. So we are learning. We were dealing with the idea of in him we live and move and have our being. And the Tibetan says, this is a fundamental, we have a statement of a fundamental law in nature, and the enunciated basis of the fact, which we cover by the rather meaningless word, omnipresence. And I was saying that omnipresence, ubiquity, everywhereness, these seem to me pretty good indicative words. And they say that Well, they kind of confirm the old idea of the mystic that break the twig and I am there. Wherever you are on the planet, you're everywhere. And you're everywhere wherever your point of tension takes you. So I'm just hoping that so far it seems to be working okay, and a little magic will have to be done. It takes a foundation in omnipresence before we can understand omniscience. And I do think omniscience is a blend of the second and third aspect, the omnipresence of the third aspect and the omniscience of the second aspect, the usual way we consider omniscience. But something of the third aspect seems necessary to me. And then an important thing the Tibetan says, omnipresence has its basis in the substance of the universe, in what the scientists call the ether. Now, I'll pause to say that we're carrying the idea of ether beyond our usual understanding of it as found on the lowest of the cosmic subplanes and on the seventh level, namely the normal, etheric, physical plane. We're carrying the ether much further than that. The ether has been discounted as necessary ever since the Michelson-Morley experiment in the late, I think, 19th century, and present science has pretty much dismissed it as necessary. But the time of its rediscovery is, I think, on the way. And that we look forward to, because it will give us a much clearer esoteric idea of how things are interconnected. DK goes on to say, this word ether is a generic term, covering, and then let's pay attention to these words, covering the ocean of energies, which are all interrelated and which constitute that one synthetic energy body of our planet. Well, we are somewhat confining the notion of ether to our planet, but if we go further, we will discover that it is universal in its nature. And basically can be considered connecting all strata of the universe. It is the great connector. Okay. Now, this is this is where I ended my program for telepathy in the etheric vehicle. That was yesterday. And basically I'm calling it a TEVVC, telepathy and the etheric vehicle video commentary. And today is the 13th. Now, we'll be starting again and it will be program 3. And we'll be starting from, we don't know yet, but it'll be page whatever. It's a long one here. Yeah, it'll still be page 2. I'm thinking that I want to let Michael do his magic with this truncated program, if possible. And hopefully, we don't know when this will start again, but maybe quite soon. Maybe after the tonight's Zoomcast. Perhaps that will happen. So this is just there's going to be a lot more about the ether as we continue. And I think it probably deserves its own treatment. I'm very sorry for that freeze. It just, it just occurred. That's all I can say. And maybe something can be done. As I said, when I get started on a book, obstacles begin to appear. I don't know why. I'd really like to be able to discuss these books with you in a manner that is illuminative. Okay. So he starts with the idea of omnipresence. He starts with the generic nature of the term ether. He speaks about a great ocean of energies, but he pretty much confines this ocean to our planet, but in terms of the ones in whom we live and move and have our being, the planetary logos is maybe the most immediate and important, but the solar logos is another one, and beyond and beyond and beyond, with all of us becoming as tiny little specks, and yet nevertheless we are living and moving and having our being within them. So I'm hoping that whatever forces, whether they are in my own consciousness or they're just arranged to help prevent me from doing this, will be overcome. So I'm going to leave it at that. And this is the second part of the second program. And again, I think a shorter program than I intended, but that seems to be the way things are presently going. So I will here sign off, and wishing you interest and a good study of this material, so that you can equip yourself to know something of what the very first group of the seed groups that DK was magnetizing, so that you can know something of their approach and their thinking. And of course, I know that I will be learning along with you very definitely.